Without further discussion, she cycled through more photos before stopping at another photograph of the two. This one was more friendly and casual, with Cora leaning jauntily on Asami's arm, grinning at the camera, while the taller woman, dressed in sturdy caving clothes with elbow pads, knee pads, and goggles, had an expression more bemused than amused. But that was nothing compared to what was behind them, a rippling, shining, disc-shaped distortion, floating freely above a rough, rocky floor in the middle of a torchlit stone cavern. "Wait, what is that?" Uchina asked. "It looks kind of like an IPO Stargate, but there's no ring around it." Cora nodded. "Close, but not quite. That's the Veil Nexus underneath Crescent Island. It had been buried for centuries before the Fire Sages found it. I found out about it when Asami and I were scouting out where Ursa was going to put its main launch facilities." Uchina considered this for several moments. "Why didn't they tell you before?" "Honestly? Mostly because they didn't want to trouble me with it, given everything else on my plate at the time. Zipang was something known among various shamans across Dichio, but they never really made real progress with it. If anything, Master Tenzin was more upset about them withholding information from me than I was." "Well, you had mellowed out a lot by then," Corwin pointed out. "Relatively speaking, of course." Tinti C, CUA 8, 196 ASC. Thursday, April 8th, Standard Year 2315. Crescent Island, Fire Nation, Dicho. "Cannot believe you would withhold information of such importance from the Avatar," Master Tenzin declared, his stentorian voice echoing around the cave. "Once we determined that it was not a spirit portal, the elders of our order concluded that it was not a phenomenon with which she should be concerned," the lead fire sage insisted. Tenzin waved his arms in frustration. "That is for her to decide, not you." Some distance away from the argument, Avatar Cora glanced at Asami Sato. Both women grinned wryly, remembering a time when Tenzin's attitude toward Cora deciding about things was rather different. Then, with a mutual shrug, they turned back to examining the silvery distortion that was the Veil Nexus, leaving the Grand Master of the Air Nomads to his argument. Tenzin was often happiest when he could have a good argument with somebody anyway. Sometimes Cora obliged him just to brighten his day. This time, Master Fire Sage Zane was doing a fine job by himself. For upwards of 10 minutes, Tenzin and Zane argued ever more vociferously about the role of the Avatar in the investigation of strange spatial phenomena. This led straight into an even louder argument between Tenzin and all five present Fire Sages about whether she should be participating in, and lending her imprimatur to, a scheme as harebrained and potentially blasphemous as Ambassador Zuko's mad idea of a rocket mission to Yue. While the learned masters were busy with that, Cora and Asami walked around the shimmering portal several times, considering it from all angles. Then, unnoticed by all the red-faced, gesticulating masters, Cora turned to Asami with a twinkle of mischief in her eyes. "Shall we, Professor Sato?" she asked, offering her hand. Asami smiled slyly, lowered her goggles over her own eyes, and took the hand, replying conspiratorially, "Through the looking glass, Avatar Cora." The argument carried on without them for another quarter hour or more. Not until Tenzin, making some point or another about the Avatar's wholehearted belief in the non-blasphemous nature of the Phoenix flight, turned to solicit her confirmation of the fact, did any of the masters think to look and see whether the woman they were all arguing about was paying any attention. When they did, they discovered to their dismay that not only wasn't she listening, she wasn't even there. "Cora?" said Tenzin, skidding to a mental and verbal halt. "Cora! Where are you? Cora!" The fire sages looked at each other, then at the airbender, and then all started talking at once. This quickly escalated into a shouting match between the fire sages themselves, all vying to be the one to say they tried to warn Tenzin, until the sudden reappearance of the Avatar startled them all into silence again. Well, part of the Avatar, anyway. Korra's head and shoulders emerged from the shimmering surface of the Veil Nexus, as though she were leaning out of a window, while the rest of her remained within. "Hey, you guys, come check this out," she said cheerfully. "It's really neat in here." Tenzin's face, flushed from his argument with the sages, went bone white. He stared at her in disbelief for a moment, then burst out in evident concern, if not incipient panic.
"Korra, what are you doing?"
Giving him a puzzled look, as if to ask what kind of question that was, Korra stepped fully out of the Nexus, then back in, then out again, then in, and leaned back through as she'd done at the beginning. Next to her, Asami's head appeared as well, a curious what's-the-hold-up-here look on her face. "Bridging the worlds," Korra told Tenzin matter-of-factly. "You coming or what?" Tenzin sputtered, attempting to appeal to Korra's intermittent sense of caution.
"Please, Korra, we need to study this phenomenon much more thoroughly before we can attempt..."
Korra rolled her eyes. "Pig chicken," she said with a challenging grin.
"Bok bok squeal!"
Then, turning to her fellow explorer, she said, "Come on, Asami, I thought I smelled something cooking over there." And the two women disappeared into the other world again, leaving Tenzin and the fire sages to stand looking at each other in utter bemusement.
"Ha ha, serves them right," Utna chortled. "That was a total dick move, especially given what the White Lotus did to you."
Korra chuckled.
"Ironically, the White Lotus had nothing to do with this one. And for what it's worth, at least I was able to listen to their explanations as to why they hadn't told me, and I agreed that they had a point. The world at large really wasn't ready to learn about Sipang yet. People would have to be brought into it slowly. Besides, Dicho was in the run-up for their first moonshot. One Veltan Shaoong altering event at a time," Corwin added. Korra grinned and then hummed thoughtfully, looking at Minami and Ryo. "You've gone quiet all of a sudden," she said. "Something on your mind?" The Satos glanced questioningly at each other. Then Minami said, in a voice that was unusually subdued for her, "Just thinking about great-great-grandma Asami. All the things she saw and did, all the lives she touched. I wish I could have known her."
"So do I," Ryo agreed. "I've heard so many stories about her, seen so many pictures, that sometimes I almost feel like I do know her." Nodding agreement, Minami hesitated for a moment, then said, "Okay, this is going to sound crazy, but sometimes when I'm working late, making a technical drawing or prototyping something, and I come up with a really good idea..." She paused, looking around at the quietly attentive faces, and with a slight blush went on, "It's like she's there with me, giving me that smile from the cover of Innovation magazine, maybe a high five." "That doesn't sound crazy at all," said Korra with a fond smile. She flipped through a few more pictures, then smiled a little wider as she found the one she wanted, the magazine cover Minami had mentioned, on which Asami, sharply dressed as ever and about the same age that her descendant was now, stood with a triumphant smile in front of a sleek and powerful-looking Sato-mobile over a bold Tongyu caption.
"What does it say?" Anthy wondered.
"Future Industries, still alive," Korra translated, regarding the image with a sentimental expression. In a quieter voice, almost to herself, she added, "Yeah, Asami was one of a kind." Then,
Looking up from the photo, she grinned at Minami and added, "Honestly, I think she was the nicest person I've ever known." "I'd say she was a hard act to follow, but I think you've got me beaten in that race," Minami said wryly. Cora laughed. "Oh, believe me, I know she was. But you know, you two do all right," she said with a wink for Ryo. "I don't think she'd have any complaints." So saying, the avatar flipped over to another photograph. "Speaking of complaints, here's somebody who swore she'd never stop complaining until she retired," she stated fondly. So, you can imagine how grumpy she got when she finally had to hang up her wire harness. She grinned as she zoomed the image, which was that of a traditional Earth Kingdom tea room, its hallway and courtyard doors open so as to let in the light and air. The decorations of the room itself were sparse, with only a few items along the periphery, the most notable a bronze roundel holding the image of a winged boar. The view from above the courtyard roofs revealed distant metal towers that put those from New Avalon in mind of their home city. In the center of the room sat two people on opposite sides of a low table, a tea service between them. To the camera's right was Cora, clad in her customary outfit, while to the left sat a much older woman, dressed in muted greens and grays. Her posture and bearing were stern, the effect enhanced by the pale iron gray of her wavy hair pulled back, and the two thin scars running in parallel between her visible cheek and jaw. The only thing that kept the woman from being grim, and carrying over into the photo itself, were the slight smiles shared between her and Cora, and the slight twinkle in the older woman's green eyes. An image of practiced, careful emotional armor, only now allowed to show a little more vulnerability after a long, long time. "Whoa, hey, who is this?" Utna asked. Before Cora could answer, Corwin grinned and interjected, "Oh, hey, it's Beifong the Younger. As an elder. Or as we know her in Valhalla, Beifong the Kind." "That's one of those ironic nicknames, isn't it?" Cora deadpanned. "Like calling the big guy tiny." Corwin nodded. "Yes, yes it is." "That doesn't answer my question, you guys," Utna commented, glancing between the two of them. "Sorry, Utna," Cora replied. "This is Lin Beifong. She was the police chief of Republic City when I first arrived here. Her mom, Toph Beifong, was the one who founded the city's metal-bending police force." "Hang on, Toph Beifong is in Eye of Destiny, Toph Beifong?" Utna asked. "It is very dark here, Toph Beifong, that Toph Beifong?" "Very dark here?" Cora mumbled quizzically, looking at Corwin. "Never mind," Corwin replied, looking slightly put upon, then said to Utna, "Yes, that Toph Beifong." "Huh. Hard to picture her as anybody's mother," Utna conceded, then added with a grin, "particularly Shanghai Lilies." "Heh, Bo was always trying to get her into the mover business, but she wasn't having it," said Cora. "Aw, who are you kidding, boy?" she'd say. "I've got a perfect face for radio." "Harsh," said Ryo. "Sometimes she even claimed that she had a face only a mother could love. Keep in mind that we all knew her mother was blind." "I stand corrected," Ryo agreed. "That's harsh." Cora nodded, regarding the picture with an expression somewhere between sentimental and glum. "She was even harder on herself than she was on everyone else. Sometimes that was the only thing that made her bearable. But..." She paused, thinking, then used a phrase she'd heard Corwin's father use many a time. "She was a person who knew what she was doing." Corwin chuckled, nodding, but said nothing. Cora gave him a curious look, realized she wasn't going to get any more out of him right now, and moved on. Oh, hey, Utena, you may recognize this one from Asami's book. This one showed Asami and Maka standing at the upper level of a large room full of banked electronic consoles and giant video screens. Both were older than they'd been in their last appearances, but they wore middle age gracefully. To Utena, Asami appeared to be about the same age as she had been in that giant crew photo in the Phoenix House lobby, and dressed similarly, too, in extremely smart business attire that was mostly a very dark red. For his part, Mako looked basically the same as he had in earlier photos, apart from his hair starting to go silver at the temples. He was dressed in simpler business clothes, a white dress shirt with the sleeves rolled up, dark slacks, and wore slim, steel-rimmed spectacles that made him look like a graphic designer. Both of them had on communications headsets of an archaic design. She held a clipboard. He was pointing to something on it with a pencil, and holding a coffee mug marked with the United Republic Space Agency logo in his other hand. "We were about halfway to UA at that point," Cora explained. "The figures they're looking at are for our mid-range course correction burn." "See? It's like I was saying earlier," Garnet said. "You take the rugged one with you on the dangerous mission, and you leave the pretty one back home to make the coffee for when you get back. It's basic resource management. Your nice-looking friend clearly understood this." Coral laughed. "Mako stayed behind because he wanted to, Garnet. He figured Asami would need his help if, well, if the rest of us didn't make it back. But we did, so it wasn't a problem. Moving on. Let's see. Bunch more Phoenix flight photos. You'll find better ones in the book. I have to see if Milo's old mover disc of the documentary still works, or if I've got to track it down on VDC. I haven't watched that in ages. We should have a showing some night soon." "Aha, here we go. What do you do for an encore when you've been to the moon?" "Well, if you're me, someone gives you your old professional sports team as a 50th birthday present, and you decide to play again." And indeed, there she was, standing with two other people in Fire Ferret's uniforms that were less archaic than the ones on the dummies at the Pro-Bending Hall of Fame, but still markedly old-timey compared to the one Corwin had worn for his own one-game stint with the modern incarnation of the team. He noticed with interest that she was wearing the red belt and helmet, not blue this time. Her teammates were both women, evidently in their late 20s or early 30s. The one on her right, in blue, was plainly of Water Tribe stock herself, while the one on the left was petite but sturdy and pale, reminding Utena a bit of the aforementioned Toph Beifong. With them was Bolin, going gray and sporting a stylish mustache that made him look boyishly mature, and still evidently in good shape. "There you have us, the 202 SCM Fire Ferrets," said Cora. "That's Kina," she added, pointing to the waterbender, "and Xian Beifong. She's from the branch of the family that stayed in Gaoling," she explained. "She was part of the launch vehicle crew on the Phoenix flight. And Kina was a Senna girl. She was Karana's great-great-grandmother, I think. Might be off a grade." She grinned. "And Coach Bolin, of course. Ah, the four of us had some good times that year, once we got used to that newfangled MLB style. Made it all the way to the semifinals. Not bad for two rookies and a retread, as Shiro's color commentator once called us. Hey, and speaking of whom..." She switched to another photo, this one depicting herself in her formal tunic and opera gloves ensemble, presenting a plaque to a white-haired but very spry-looking old man who was beaming from ear to ear. "Here's me at the 202 Broadcasting Arts Awards," she said. "I had the great privilege of presenting that year's Broadcast Journalism Lifetime Achievement Award to none other than the great Shiro Shinobi himself. The voice of professional bending, the face of RTV's coverage of the Phoenix flight, a man so dedicated to his profession that he kept reporting the equalist attack on the arena in 171, even after the lousy creeps all but shocked him to death. Shiro was one of the all-time greats. Even today, most of the people who cover MLB for radio are just trying to be him." And failing, Ryo put in, drawing sage nods from his sister and Korra. Yep, Korra agreed. Shiro was an original. She lingered for a moment longer on the picture, then flipped onward through the list. Getting on toward dinner time. Better think about wrapping this up soon. Okay, let's skip ahead a little. Here's some of the stuff you missed in the last 5 years, Corwin. Let's see, come on. Aha! Yes. For instance, I believe you know this lady. It took Corwin a few seconds to process the next image and see that she was correct. For a second, he almost said, "Well, yeah, that's you. Even wearing a dress, I can tell that." But the person Korra was talking about was not Korra herself, nor Minami, both of whom were present. They were both standing, Korra in a discreetly glamorous number Corwin had never seen before, but which bore the subtly unmistakable hallmarks of Ming and Daughters, clothiers. Minami looking movie star sensational in slinky but classy black silk, on what appeared to be the red carpet at a film premiere. Behind them stood a long black Future Industries limousine, surrounded by a crowd of press photographers, over several of whose heads Neri was looking with interest. Standing between Korra and Minami was a third woman, and it was she whom Corwin took a few seconds to recognize, because her presence there was at once perfectly in and entirely out of context. The red carpet was Sumire Kanzaki's natural habitat, but Dichio most certainly was not. "When was Sumire here?" Corwin asked. "Couple years ago," Korra replied, pleased at having been able to surprise him so completely. She and a film unit spent a couple of months in town shooting a picture, The Crimson Lizard and the Case of the Criminal Councilman, and then she came back a while later for the premiere. "What, she never told you?" "For shame," Kate added. "I'm always the last to know," Corwin grumbled. "It's so true," said Anthy with a hint of wistfulness, causing Corwin to sigh in a put-upon fashion, Utena to roll her eyes good-naturedly, and Korra to snicker. "It was a whirlwind shoot," Korra went on. "I mean, I thought our film industry worked at a fast pace, but I've never seen anybody cut a mover like Sumire before. I'm amazed they got it out the door that fast, and that it was such a success." "It was the foreign director that drew all the interest, you know," Minami pointed out. "Aw, is somebody jealous?" Korra replied with a sidelong grin. "Maybe a little," Minami admitted. "Anyway, I know Milo's disc of that one works. We just watched it again a couple months ago. Another thing to put on the list for mover night. What else have we got? Boring Avatar business." So saying, she clicked to a picture of the solemn-faced, gray-clad figure of Inspector Imanishi, standing behind a microphone-studded podium in front of police headquarters. The inspector seemed to be speaking, with Korra, in what appeared to be modified police armor, differently colored than the stock gear and lacking the insignia, and a number of cheerful-looking young officers standing in a group off to one side. Behind them, Neri could once again be seen, looking out over Korra's head. She appeared to have slightly startled the cop to the avatar's right. "Hey, nice," said Utena. "I'm digging the super cop look." "Remember what Minami said earlier about men in uniform?" Corwin mused. "Works for women, too. I'm just saying." "It's so true," Anthy repeated with exactly the same wistful sigh, making Utena giggle. "Oh, here's a good one. This was the Air Kids demonstration for Avatar Day last year," said Korra. "Hey, Nima still had hair," said Utena. "So she did," Corwin agreed, nodding. Nima and her sister were both in the picture, as were Tenzin, Gyatso, and a couple of other young airbenders the visitors hadn't seen around. They were playing a game of three-a-side airball on a court that seemed to have been set up in Railway Square, the sisters and Tenzin against Gyatso and the two unknown older teens. Despite being younger and smaller, Nima and Lakpa's team was winning, according to the scoreboard visible in the background. Among the crowd at the base of the Fire Lord Zuko statue, the viewers could see Korra, clearly engaged in some purely non-partisan, of course, cheering. Behind her, Neri's head and shoulders towered over her and the other spectators around her. "Oh, hey," Korra said, putting up a picture of a small group of formerly robed teenagers grinning and brandishing rolled-up parchments. "Karana and Azana's graduation from Piandao Academy." "You missed that, too, or you'd have known Azana already," said Korra, nudging Corwin with an elbow.
"They've known each other that long," Anthy said, sounding slightly surprised.
"Yeah, they were roommates all 7 years at Piandao, starting when they were 11," Korra told her. She flipped to a second photo, just showing the two of them in their graduation robes. And Neri. Two young women on one of the best days of their lives so far, plainly in love with life and ready to go out and grab it. Their enthusiasm was so infectious that everyone looking at the photo found him or herself smiling. Korra virtually thumbed through a few more pictures that were pleasant but of no particular significance. A postcard panorama of Republic City's Harmony Tower. A shot of herself and Neri in front of her house in Senna with the caption, "Greetings from the South Pole," made as a humorous seasonal greeting card a couple of years before, and seemed to be thinking about ending the show when Utrina realized something and laughed.
"Ha! I just noticed that Neri is in all these photos," she remarked.
"Yep," Korra confirmed, nodding. "That's her thing. That and eating. She's the South Pole's greatest photo bomber." With a wry shrug, she went on, "Don't look at me. I only raised her." She checked a couple more folders, then gave a nostalgic sigh and said,
"Well, I guess that ought to do it for now. I really have to sort these better. I know there's a bunch more in here that you guys would be interested in.
You two in particular," she added with a wink for Uchna and Anthy, "will want to see all my pictures of little Corwin."
"Oh, you've got that right," said Uchna, grinning.
"I... tell you what, hang on a second. I'm pretty sure I know where I can find one of those to hold you for now." Bending to her search with renewed energy, she muttered,
"Come on, where are you? I put you someplace where I wouldn't..."
"Aha!" And with a final flourish, she put up the last of the day's trips into memory. It depicted a room that Utrina, after a moment's consideration, recognized as the living room of Corwin's father's house in New Avalon. Korra sat beaming in the middle of the brown leather sofa, with the unmistakable form of Nall draped on one shoulder and a shyly smiling little girl in her lap. On her left was a cheerfully smirking Kay Morgan, holding a swaddled bundle topped with a shock of red hair. On her right, a somewhat more serenely smiling Skuld Ravenhair, cradling a very similar item whose hair was black.
"Oh my, is that you, Kate?"
Utrina asked, delight in her voice, as she leaned forward to take a closer look. Caitlin nodded.
"Sure is."
"Aw, you were adorable," said Rio.
Then, looking thoughtful, he added,
"I mean, you still are, but differently."
Minami snorted. "And people ask me how it is that you're still single," she observed dryly, but Kate only giggled.
"Thank you, Rio," she said.
"And baby Lennon Corwin,"
Utrina added, pointing.
"Wow, look how little they are."
"Well, they ought to be. They're 2 days old," said Korra with a grin.
"Look, Annabelle," Anthy said. "It's your father and your Uncle Leonard, when they weren't much older than you are."
"And there's Nall getting his Mac on, 2 days out of the shell," Corwin remarked, pointing. "So you see where Garnet gets her fast moves from."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Garnet piously.
2 days old, really?"
Utrina mused.
"Wow, Kay looks great."
Korra laughed.
I actually asked her if she was a goddess, too, like Skuld, and she laughed and said, "Nah, I just cheat like a mofo."
"Ha!" said Kate. "Yeah, that sounds like Mom."
At the mention of Kay, the moment trembled briefly on the verge of sinking from nostalgia to mourning. But Kate, knowing that her mother would never have approved of that, pushed it aside and said, "So you had known Dad for..." Cora nodded. "2 days. We met the day Corwin was born," she added, reaching over to muss the young god's hair.
"Man, that's just addictive," she mused after a moment, then did it again.
"I know," Utina said. "It's my favorite thing about him." Corwin arched an eyebrow at her.
"I dispute that assertion."
"Ha!" said Minami. "Anyway," said Cora, "it's true. I met Griff in New Avalon that day. Wanted to talk to him about the really loud noise we'd heard in the spirit world 9 months before."
"Wonder what that could have been," said Minami mischievously.
Corwin coughed. An hour or so later, we were on Tomodachi and, stuff was happening, Cora went on. 2 days later, with Kay and Len home from the hospital and Skuld back on her feet and ready to travel, he invited me over to the house to hang out and, well, rest is history. She sat back and grinned. "And that's as good a note as any to end story time on for today, I think."
"No wonder you guys are buddies for life," Utina remarked, and Cora wasn't sure whether she meant herself and Corwin, herself and Griffin, or both.
Then the Rose Prince added, "How long after that was it before Skuld put a lens on you? Naughty of you, by the way, busting that out on me without warning when I already had all I could do not to witter at Anthy."
Cora chuckled.
"Sorry. Slipped my mind, believe it or not. It doesn't work across the Veil, and there are only a handful of other lensmen in Dicho, most of whom I can get in touch with by conventional means any time I like. So sometimes I forget about it when I'm not outside."
"What's yours look like?" Utina inquired, pushing back her sleeve to reveal the lambent rose-pink glow of her own.
"Ooh," said Minami, leaning forward with widened eyes.
"Now see what you've done, you little show-off," Corwin Mock groused.
"Sorry," said Utina, who wasn't sorry.
Cora chuckled again.
"If you're good and eat your vegetables, Minami, I'll put in a word for you next time Skuld's in town. Which shouldn't be that long from now, actually. When are they getting out here to see their grandchild?" she asked Corwin.
"Not sure," Corwin replied.
"They probably need a few days to stop freaking out about it," he added wryly.
"Ha, probably," Cora agreed. Then said to Utina, "Here, have a look."
So saying, she rolled back the bracer on her right forearm to uncover her wrist. This revealed a circular gem set into a blued silver band, similar in setting to Utina's, with curved, ribbed elastic metal links. What was different about the gem was its color. Cora's was not one color, but three, arranged in a distinctive pattern. Against a backdrop of pure, shining white, glowed a curving geometric pattern of a cleanly lustrous blue, similar to the blue Utina had noticed commonly appearing in Cora's clothes, arranged around a narrow, curved-sided diamond of a darker blue.
"Wow," said Utina. "That's beautiful. I've never seen one with a pattern on it before."
Cora regarded her lens with a fond smile.
"That's Rava," she said, "the Avatar spirit. The other half of my soul, you might say. When she had a separate existence as a spirit of light, that's what she looked like."
"Amazing," Utina said, then quipped, "That must have taken some custom fitting."
"Now that's kind of a long story, believe it or not," Cora replied, then added with a wink, "Maybe I'll tell you about it sometime."
Then, with a last fond look at the photo of herself and what was at the time most of Griffin's family, She rolled her bracer back down over her lens and started shutting down her laptop.
Right now, I'd say it's about time for us to think about heading over for dinner.
Now there's a cue if I ever heard one, said Maki's voice from the doorway.
She and Izumi, dressed in civvies, entered the room, bearing between them a large, bucket-shaped object.
This proved, when set down and unpacked, to be a multi-leveled bamboo arrangement for carrying prepared food.
Master Jinora's kitchen sends dinner for everyone, with her compliments, so that Lady Anthy need not be left alone for the afternoon meal, said Izumi with a smile as she started handing out plates.
Ah, the famous Air Nomad hospitality, said Ryo happily, cracking a fresh pair of chopsticks.
If you don't mind, we'll stay and eat with you, said Maki, only slightly hesitant about inviting herself.
We're heading back to Kyoshi Island tonight, she explained, so this will be our last chance to see you for a while.
With a wry grin for Corwin, she added, hopefully not quite as long a while this time.
Bet on that, he said.
By all means, join us, Anthy agreed. There are more chairs in the hall. Corwin, be a dear.
They dined informally in this cheerful, sun-drenched setting, from collapsible tables or plates balanced on knees or just the free end of the futon, making pleasant conversation. Juniper arrived toward the end, virtually bouncing into the room to inform her sensei breathlessly that the afternoon's practice had gone very well indeed. The pawns checked in shortly thereafter, having been out who knew where, getting all windswept and picturesque.
"So, has anyone seen Null since this morning?" Amy wondered.
"Nope, no sign of him," said Uchina. "This is perhaps not that surprising," put in Corwin dryly, making her snicker.
"What did I miss?" Ryo wondered.
He and Lakpa, sort of," said Corwin, trailing off with a vague, you-know-the-rest-of-this-verse gesture.
"Oh," said Ryo, nodding thoughtfully. "She finally caught him, eh?" he added with a wry grin.
"Or he caught her," said Utena. "I'm trying not to look that closely."
Ryo nodded again, repeating,
"Oh."
"Well," said Minami pragmatically after a moment's thought, "I hope at least one of them has acquired some rudimentary capacity for discretion, or Jinora may become the first airbender in history to kill a dragon."
"Be nice, Min Min," Ryo chided her.
At meal's end, the party dispersed. Anne excused herself first, remarking that she was beat after a day of throwing her chi at the wall. The phrase made Kate, Cora, and Corwin, all of whom had heard Izana say it, glance at each other with little smiles, and wanted her bed badly. She bade everyone a fond good night and took herself off to it. After packing up the dishes in the empty food carrier, Maki and Izumi semi-formally took their leave with bows and polite words, though Maki was hardly allowed to get away with that, and received a sound hug from both Corwin and Uchina before she left. Amy and Rory went along to see them off at the train station, and shortly thereafter the Satos prepared to depart as well, saying their goodbyes and nice meeting yous to Anthy, Annabelle, and Garnet. Corwin and Cora went with them back out to their autogyro and helped them get it untied and ready to go.
"I'll see you in the morning, son," said Ryo, shaking Corwin's hand. "What time are you figuring on leaving? I'll see if I can't get out here by 9 or so."
"Why don't we just pick you up?" Corwin wondered. "I mean, it's Rohan's party. I assume we'll be going by Sky Bison, wherever we're headed. I'll call you when we leave."
Ryo nodded.
"Okay, sounds good. We're still in the same place as before."
"Goodbye, Corwin," said Minami, hugging him warmly. "It's been wonderful to see you again, and I really enjoyed meeting your family. Your daughter's lovely."
She kissed him on the cheek and let him go, giving him a twinkling emerald wink. I was kidding before, but it does make a girl think, she added with a grin, then trailed her fingertips along the line of his bearded jaw as she turned away and headed for the aircraft. Ready to go, Rio? Getting an affirmative thumbs up from the back, Minami climbed into the front cockpit, made certain the prop and rotors were clear, and fired up the autogyro. Then spun the rotors up to full RPM, cut the power to the rotor head, gunned the main engine, and took off. The aircraft jumped into the air after only a short run across the grass by the Bagua Circle. Corwin and Cora stood together and waved until the autogyro was just a dot and a winking running light far out across the bay, then turned to each other. Well, said Cora, I've got some stuff I have to do. Besides, you four deserve some alone together time. It's been a busy day. So saying, she hugged him the way she had when he was a kid, picking his feet up off the ground, and when she put him down, he did the same in turn to her. Then she, too, kissed him on the cheek, murmuring, Good night, Corwin. Night, he said, and she broke away and trotted off toward the ladies' quarters, giving him a wave back over one shoulder. He watched her go, smiling to himself, and then turned and walked back to Tenzin's house. Evening was settling in, the shadows beginning to lengthen and a touch of springtime chill to enter the air, but they stayed in the sun parlor all the same to eke out every last drop of the beautiful day that they could. Having seen to Annabelle's frequent but not onerous needs while Corwin was parting from the Satos, Anthy was sitting up reading as Baby and Dragon dozed in her lap. When she'd returned to the futon after the operations, she'd settled nearer to the edge. Uchna, in the middle, slid over a bit closer so that Corwin, in turn, would have room to lie beside her. While Anthy read, they quietly, contentedly cuddled next to her, discussing the day's events and how well the meeting with Emily had finally turned out. An hour or so later, Anthy reached the end of the hardback volume she was reading, closed it, and asked, Corwin, dear, would you do me a favor? Sure, said Corwin. What do you need? I've finished my book a bit sooner than I was expecting, she said, holding up that item. Would you please take this one back to the Air Temple's library and bring me back the next volume? She said, offering him the book. I can do that, he said agreeably, rising. Walking around to her side of the futon, he bent and took the book. Glancing at the spine, he grinned. Aha, he said. Avatar Yangchen's memoirs. I think you would have gotten along with Yangchen. He bent further and gave her a kiss, then headed off down the hall and out of the house. Despite the Air Nomad's well-deserved reputation for being an orderly and scholarly people, the Air Temple's library was not very well curated, or at least Corwin had never thought so. If the way it was organized had some underlying logic, it had always eluded his own mind. It took him several minutes to find the rest of Yangchen's memoirs, and they weren't filed in what he would have thought of as order, either, so further hunting was required to find the volume he, or rather Anthy, actually wanted. He was still engaged in that task when he noticed, out of the corner of his eye, that one of the library's side doors was open. He turned to find Nima standing framed in the doorway, regarding him with a hard-to-read expression. When his eyes fell upon her, she blinked and reddened slightly, taking a half-step back as though she intended to retreat. "Oh, hey, Nima," said Corwin, preoccupied enough with his task not to notice the details. "What's up?" "Oh, nothing. Nima began." But then, with a startled yelp, she suddenly lurched into the room, bounding over the threshold to keep from falling over it, as she was unexpectedly shoved from behind. "Nima has something she wants to tell you, Corwin,"
said Lakva cheerfully from the hall. Then she slid the door shut with a bang and could be heard trotting off down the hall, humming tunelessly. Nima stood a couple of feet inside the closed door, feet a little awkwardly placed where she'd had to put them for balance, her face crimson and gray eyes wide with horror. She looked back over her shoulder, saw that the door was closed, and seemed to be weighing the possibility of just crashing through it to escape, then turned back to Corwin with a look of helpless dismay. For his part, Corwin just looked baffled. He had seen the often contentious relationship between the two sisters take many different turns over the years, but this was a new one on him. Nima looked terribly perturbed about something, out of all proportion to what Lakva had just done. All the calm, easygoing serenity she'd manifested on this visit, the payoff, he assumed, for the diligent study and discipline she'd undertaken to earn her master airbender's arrow so young, had deserted her with her elder sister's precipitous act, and she found herself hovering on the brink of blind panic. He couldn't let that go on if he could help it. "Hey," he said, his voice gentle. "What's the matter? You look like she just trapped you in a cave with a wild animal."
I,
Nima stammered, her face going even redder. "Come on," said Corwin, holding out an open hand. "It's just me. I'm not going to bite you." He grinned wryly. "Whatever it is, it can't be that bad." Nima hesitated, her continued impulse to flee warring with her innately honest, trusting heart. She took a slow step toward him, then another. Then she paused again and just looked at him, one fist pressed against her lips to stop them trembling. She stayed that way for a few seconds, breathing deeply, visibly getting herself under control. Then, in a tiny, brittle voice, she said,
"I love you."
Corwin looked back at her, his ice blue eyes widening slightly, not with alarm or even particular surprise, but a vast and warm compassion. He didn't flinch from the intensity in her eyes, nor the raw and aching vulnerability of her, didn't recoil from her declaration or seek to distance himself from it, physically or verbally. Instead, with a warm, slightly sad smile, he opened his hands and said softly, "Aw, Nima, come here." She went to his arms, not embracing him in turn, but putting her hands against his broad chest and resting her head between them instead. The wool of his sweater was soft on her cheek and smelled faintly of cedar. Now that she'd made a start at confessing, the rest of it spilled out of her in a low, husky murmur, the words almost jumbling together as they rushed to escape.
"I've had a crush on you since I was 10, but then you were gone for 6 years, and now you're back, and you have a child, and you're married, and I'm supposed to be a master air nomad, and I should be able to move beyond all that kind of thing, but I just can't. I'm so sorry."
"Hey, no, shh," said Corwin soothingly, enclosing her in his powerful arms. "You don't have anything to be sorry about." Nima's eyes were moist as she raised her head, when not ducking against his chest, she was nearly as tall as he, to look at him.
"Are you angry?" she asked.
"No, of course not," Corwin said. Then, downcast, he went on, "I'm a little sad, because..." He hesitated, then went on with regret in his voice. "Nothing I can say right now won't hurt you." Nima lowered her head, resting her cheek against his chest again.
"It's all right," she said softly. "I wasn't expecting. I wasn't even going to mention it."
Corwin nodded, holding her a little tighter. "I know, but it still makes me sad. I don't like hurting people I care about. And I do care about you, Nima. I don't ever want you to doubt that.
but I can't give you what you want.
Nima nodded, her face still pressed to his chest, and asked without looking up,
Is it because I'm ugly?
Stop that, Corwin said, levering her chin up so that she had to look at him.
You're not ugly, Nima. The only ugly thing about you is your belief that you are. You're sweet and kind and incredibly brave and honest. I mean, you could have run away just now, or you could have tried to bluff your way out, but you didn't. No one can ever take any of those things away from you.
Corwin saw a shadow cross her eyes then, and couldn't help but smile wryly.
I know. You're thinking, well, if he thinks I'm so great, then why...
She reddened slightly and ducked her head again.
I don't know, he said. Not even the gods know how these feelings work, only that they are what they are.
He lowered his own head onto her shoulder, squeezing her in her arms again, and said quietly,
So, I'm sorry.
He kissed the top of her head, prickly fuzz and all, and added in a near whisper,
I hate to let you down.
Nemo made a sound that was half laugh and half sniffle, then said quietly into his sweater,
You're not letting me down. I let myself down. Some master airbender I am. We're supposed to be able to let go of earthly attachments, and here I am.
She let out a faint whimper.
Great-grandmother would be so disappointed in me.
Jinora was 16 once, Corwin said. Airbending master or not, she knows you're not a machine. With a faint, wry chuckle, he added,
Where do you think your grandfather came from?
Nima giggled in spite of herself, then raised her red-rimmed eyes to his again.
Even now you can make me laugh, she said.
Well, I'm glad I can help a little bit anyway, said Corwin. I'm sorry it couldn't be more. If it's any consolation, I do love you, Nima. Just not the way you were hoping. He paused, then grumbled self-critically, That was less lame in my head. Nima sniffle-giggled again. Then she did put her arms around him in turn, burying her face deeper in his sweatered chest, and said in a muffled voice,
I'll take it.
He was visibly out of sorts when he returned, later than expected, to the sun parlor of Tenzin the Elder's house. Both Utena and Anthy noticed it. With a shared glance, they decided between them who would raise it, and it was Utena who beckoned him to settle on the futon between them, then asked him softly,
What's the matter?
Corwin gave her a thoughtful, slightly mournful look, considering his reply carefully, and then said,
I just had to break one of the kindest, gentlest, most loving hearts I know.
Ah, said Anthy with an understanding nod.
Nima.
You knew? Corwin wondered.
Everybody knows, Anthy replied. I'm surprised she broached the subject, though. It isn't like her to do something she knows will cause a disruption. However much healthier for her, it's likely to be that she's pulled off the scab.
Lakpa sort of forced her hand, said Corwin ruefully, and he explained what had just happened in the library.
Huh. Classy, Utrina grunted, frowning. Someone needs to teach that girl a lesson or two.
I intend to let her know as soon as I see her that I don't appreciate the way she treats her sister, Corwin said, nodding. I mean, they've always had kind of an adversarial relationship, but what she just did was beyond the pale. There's no excuse for treating someone like that.
He sighed. Nima's 3 years younger than Lakpa, Nal, and me, so I can't remember when she was born, but I do remember her as a toddler, then a little girl. Lakpa and all, too, sometimes, used to consider her kind of a nuisance, the tag-along little sister. Me, I never saw her that way. She's always been interesting. He lay back against the upright part of the futon and stretched out his arms along the back, one behind Anthy, the other behind Utrina, and sighed. When I was 11 and she was 8, and Lakpa was out chasing Nall around, Nima taught me the ancient airbender's language, Sherba. It's nearly a dead language nowadays, but she wanted to read to me from the writings of Gyatso the Wise, Avatar Aang's mentor, and she didn't want anything to be lost in translation. He smiled slightly at the memory. That's the kind of mind she has. Huh, wow, said Utrina, nestling into the crook of his arm. How long did that take? 3 weeks, Corwin said. When she glanced at him in surprise, he shrugged a little sheepishly and said, I'm good with languages. Get it from Dad. It's a Dedian thing. Well, said Anthy after a few moments' thought, I hope you were gentle with her, assuming, of course, you don't reciprocate her feelings. I was, Corwin assured her, and I don't. Well, I do when I don't. I mean, I do love her, and I don't mind saying so, to you, or her, or anybody. She's an old friend and a genuinely beautiful soul. But I'm not in love with her. He sighed. Philos, but no Eros. Standard needs more words. Anthy agreed. They lay together, lost in thought, for perhaps half an hour, during which time the last of the sunset filled the room with red light and ever longer shadows from the west. Nobody bothered getting up to turn on any lights until it was almost fully night, and then only because Annabelle required routine maintenance that could not readily be accomplished in the dark. That homely task seemed to return them all from their respective reveries, though, and, with Annabelle fed, changed, and awake for the moment, the revitalized trio and their offspring and dragon turned happily to piling up some of what used, in Corwin's father's youth, to be called quality time. A while later, Utrina had to retire to the smallest room by herself for a time. When she emerged and headed back toward the sun parlor, she discovered that the hall offered an excellent vantage point on the daybed well before the threshold. From this angle, Garnet was hidden in the covers somewhere, but everyone else was perfectly visible. Utrina paused about halfway along the corridor and leaned against the wall, arms folded, and quietly watched with a fond smile while Corwin and Anthy played with their infant daughter. They were such a perfect little picture, the three of them. Mother, father, child. She hadn't anticipated how right they would all look together. And just like that, the feeling from last night was back. Suddenly, without warning, she felt like a voyeur, possibly even an intruder, and she knew that walking back into that room in this condition would be both unfair to them and possibly unbearable to herself. They would sense her disquiet. They would ask her about it, all in loving concern, and how could she ever admit to them, these people she had sworn never to lie to or hide things from, that she abruptly felt like an outsider in her own family? Silently, she took herself away, from the parlor, the scene, the house itself. She had to get out, get some air, try to figure out what she was feeling, and what in all the world she could do about it.